Good evening, Little Saigon, Seattle. Good evening to all my friends out there who are out there someplace. Maybe you're stuck in the woods. Maybe you're in the Grand Canyon. Maybe you're rafting on the Amazon River, currently being stalked by the giant catfish. What are they called? I don't know, but they're huge, and they're coming for you. It is September. Oh my gosh, it is September the 21st. I can't believe it. 2020. Right around 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and I'm talking to my good friend Cecil from Canada. What's up, dude?
How much, man? What's happening down in Little Saigon there?
The good news is, in the last week, I haven't really heard any automatic fire. So that's good news.
Well, that is good news. You still out hearing the crazy scream at night?
Yeah, but it's not, I think it may be... I think there may be illegal bum fights going on in the park nearby, and I think I may be hearing that. Like, I think they may be paying bums to fight each other to the death. And the thing is, you'd say, well, Dan, wouldn't you want to go out and videotape that? And what I would say is, please meditate on that question, because I just said illegal bum fights. So, yeah, it could be illegal bum fights being held in the empty, empty area, empty park, empty block. Yeah. Don't know,
Dan. Yeah, I think you'd be better off just not bothering with that.
Well, I know, exactly. It's like, do you interrupt an illegal bum fight? And my general opinion is no.
I'd have to go with no, too, man. It doesn't sound like anything good would come of that.
No, I don't think so. So the main topic for tonight, the core topic is... Imagine you were in the woods, and for now, let's just pretend you're generally in North America. But again, we don't want to overgeneralize, because North America has many habitats, many flora, many fauna, and so we don't want to just generalize and say North America, but let's be more specific. Let's say places like Alberta, or Central Canada, places or places like, I'm familiar with, Pacific Northwest. If you're in the woods and you need to find food, what do you do? How do you start that process? And more importantly, how much time do you have? Like, if you're in the woods and you're just there, how much time do you have to get your shit together with food, water, and shelter, do you think?
Well, obviously the first question is what season are you in? If you're in summer, you have an abundance of time to get your shit together as compared to... Certainly, and we might as well just go to the Pacific Northwest here. I actually grew up in British Columbia, and I spent a lot of time in the woods there. So, I can talk pretty well on that geographic area anyways. Obviously, it rains there a lot in the fall and in the winter. So, primary concern is not dying of hypothermia. And, as far as wilderness, I don't know why you would be there, but let's just assume there's some sort of accident and you ended up there. The biggest thing that's going to kill you is probably exposure. After that, of course, you have water would be your second problem. You can live for quite a while, a couple of weeks, without eating. But the problem becomes when people get hungry, they get tired, and you get tired and hungry, they make really poor decisions. So getting your shit together is really imperative right in the first few days. Because if you don't, things will likely go downhill pretty quick for you.
Well,
go ahead. Nope, you go ahead.
No, I felt like you had an idea in your head, so I want to let you go. I interrupted you.
Well, that's sort of one of the biggest things. And the hard to talk about discussion where, obviously people... want to know, well, what am I going to eat? What am I going to do? And certainly there is food to eat in the bush and in the Pacific Northwest, even in the wintertime. But it's not quite as glamorous as I think a lot of people would like to believe it is. You're not exactly going to sharpen a stick and go hunt mule deer, for example. There, it's just not a realistic situation for anyone who's unprepared or didn't go specifically to do such a thing. I think your best bet as far as eating goes is actually to eat bugs. mean, certainly there's quite a few plants out there that you can eat, but do you have the knowledge base and do you have the prerequisite understanding of what it is you can eat, how you test what you can eat, and should you be eating it? I mean, there's plenty of edible mushrooms. There's also mushrooms that'll give you diarrhea and or worse.
Yeah.
So when it comes to sort of a survival situation, you know, if you didn't plan to go out there, you're better off to get out of that situation as quickly as possible. And that's my take. And I mean, that's how I would be if I was forced into a situation such as off the top of my head would be an airplane crash. Say a small airplane goes down or a helicopter goes down quite a ways in the back country, and you're not necessarily prepared to be there. Hopefully you have some decent clothing on. The best thing to do is to do everything in order to get yourself out of that situation while not hurting yourself and dying in the process.
Right. This is the thing, though. Like, for example, water. Let's talk about water for a second, because water is critical. You can only really survive for a few days without fresh sources of water. Isn't that true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, without a fresh source of water, you're in a really, really bad situation. Fortunately, the water is both a curse and a blessing in the rainforest there, in that there's plenty of water to find. Hopefully you have some sort of method to transport the water in between the creeks. The downside there is the constant rain.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're going to be exposed, and if you're not wearing some decent clothing when you end up there, the water might be sort of one of the least of your concerns, whereas getting wet, staying wet, and then just becoming hypothermic is probably what's going to do you in.
Well,
as far as water goes, as far as drinking water goes, I've found myself plenty of times out in the backcountry. I was very fortunate when I was younger and that I worked for a geologist, and I worked in a lot of mining camps, small mining camps, remote mining camps. I worked in a lot of remote forestry camps and spent a lot of time in very, very remote situations where you brought what you had. If you didn't bring enough water for the day, you had to find water. And on plenty of occasions, I've drank it out of creeks, streams, and even some more unfortunate places, and I haven't gotten sick. Now, the one thing you have to remember is that no matter what size of creek, what size of stream, if something is shitty in there just upstream from you, the chances of getting cryptosporidium or getting basically cryptosporidium, which is what they call beaver fever, goes up dramatically. The smaller the river or creek and the less amount of flow it has, just in my mind, generally increases the odds of getting sick. At least when it's flowing, there's a better chance that even if something shit up there, it had been washed away by the time you actually took a drink out of the creek.
Right.
So you kind of want to be looking for a faster flowing, you know, where you can. Obviously, you're going to take what you can get.
I've heard...
Especially in a survival situation.
Yeah. Like, when I was a kid, so my dad was a logger. And when I was a kid, I would go with him when he would, like, bid... When he would bid a logging job and he would survey some property, I would go with him. And I remember thinking to myself, just intuitively, that the tastiest water seemed to look like the water that was moving quickly. And I don't know if that's a biological thing, but what I have read over the years is what you said, that fast-moving water is a better source, aerated water is a better source for fresh water than anything moving slowly, obviously, or just still water. And definitely very small creeks, you got to be careful. The problem is, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you're in places like the desert, you might come across water and it might only be a little creek. And so then what, you know?
Well, and then you're going to have to take your chances. I mean, I was I worked in Panama in the jungle for a while. And of course, it's very hot, it's very humid. And I actually had an accident. I lost almost all of our water for the day. And we were working out of a remote location, out of a helicopter, and there was no more water, and it was noon. So I ended up actually drinking out of a creek that I really didn't want to, and I did end up getting a parasite out of it, actually. they, either way you want to put it, I still would have been able to walk out of that bush having drank in that. And if I hadn't, I probably would have had to call a helicopter in. So again, when you're in a situation, sometimes you just have to do what you have to do, right?
Yeah.
The whole Bear Grylls drinking your urine thing, I don't think is really much of a solution other than the very last ditch effort not to die.
Yeah.
So
if
you can find a little creek or some source of water, I mean, and there's certainly ways to get water in the desert, but most of it, you need to have some sort of materials with you, such as clear cellophane and some other materials that typically, if you weren't going out there specifically, you probably wouldn't have.
Well, you know, the other thing I wanted to point out too is when we say the Pacific Northwest, this is something that people don't get, and I don't think they understand about the northwest of Canada either. Is it like in eastern Washington, especially prior to the BPA, the Bonneville Power Administration under FDR, in eastern Washington, you basically have a desert. And so even though it's the same, I'm in the same latitude, so to speak, it's a very different climate just a few hundred miles to my east, you know? Very different, or I should say, yeah, very different environment, very different kind of place to be, a very different type of environment to survive in. And it's one of those things that springs to mind, like, you know, how do you navigate the reality that in one particular place like Washington State, you can find mountains, desert, rainforests, as you pointed out, and there isn't really a one-size-fits-all when it comes to water. Like, my friend AJ and I, we talked about water a lot on podcasts before, mainly purifying water, and how critical it is, because that's one of the things. You're right, and I want to go back to this. You're right, the number one problem you face in the wild at first is exposure. But if you solve the exposure problem, you really do need to find water next, don't you think? That's really the next problem to solve.
Yeah, it absolutely is the next problem, especially clean water or the best water you can come by.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, the chances of getting diarrhea dramatically increase when your water, the worst water, the more stagnant water, the slower flowing, you know, the more brackish the water, the more turbidity. I mean, you're asking for a dramatic increase in ending up with diarrhea, and that's not going to end well for you, especially if you're in any place where the only water you can get is going to give you diarrhea. Things aren't going to go well for you at all.
You're going to die. Diarrhea, where you don't have enough water,
likely,
is like a death sentence, really.
Absolutely it is. No, absolutely. I mean, if you're fortunate that you were able to make fire, you know, if you had a knife and you had a flint, or you were fortunate enough to know how to, I mean, there is ways to use quartz rock. Now, it depends where you are. If you're in the Cascade Mountains, you probably be able to find it. And then you can use your knife, the steel and the quartz, to actually light a fire. If you don't already know how to do that, though, it's never going to happen. But there are ways can make fire if you're somewhat knowledgeable and prepared. And if you had a tin can, you could at least boil the water, and that would sort of eliminate a lot of those problems.
Yeah.
But then again, you have to have a certain amount of supplies with you, and you have to also be prepared to understand how to use those supplies. I mean, for the vast majority of people, they live in cities, and even walking out in the forest can be off the sort of path can be a bit of a challenge. So,
oh yeah, I mean,
that's sort of another consideration.
Yeah, dude. Like, I grew up around the wilderness, but I was never a wilderness person really growing up. Like, I went on hikes and stuff, and you know, I would go with my dad to look at property, but when I was a kid, I never really did a lot of like the Boy Scout kind of stuff, and so I think about this stuff and I think, what would I do? How would I survive? And the realistic answer is, I just don't know. I don't know if I would make it. I think a big part of it is how can I say this? Don't panic. If you panic, then you will probably die. Like, don't panic is a good, you know. I guess I'm ripping off a Hitchhiker's Guide, sorry.
Well, no, but honest to God, the thing that probably kills more people that are unprepared out in the bush is just blind stupidity, you know, just not thinking and being in a panic state of mind and not knowing, not even having a clue what to do. You know, how many people have been locked out in the bush and they didn't even know that the human body, one leg, you have one leg shorter than the other. If you don't pay attention, you will continually walk in circles.
Yep.
Like you need, so anyone who's is in that situation, hopefully they can realize and remember, and I doubt that it happens very often, the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west.
Right.
Well, that gives you every direction. Now, if you can see it, I mean, eventually at some point in the day, hopefully you can see where the sun is, and hopefully you have the presence of mind to sort of have kept track of the hours that have gone by since the sun rose, so you can sort of gauge where you are.
Right.
Because if you can't gauge where you are, you know, that's, and let's say in the Pacific Northwest, you go down on a plane somewhere, well, just following, you know, the age-old adage, if you follow a creek, it'll lead to a river, follow a river, eventually it's going to lead to the ocean. Well, that could be a couple hundred miles in the wrong direction at first, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it could very well be a bad, so, yeah, go ahead.
No, I just, I think the whole survival thing is a fascinating topic. I think, unfortunately, a lot of the realities of it, though, are not necessarily, and I don't mean you, but I just mean in general, like, the listeners or something, they may not know. I think the realities of it are pretty harsh and not what they want to hear. A lot of people, I think, have some sort of a glamorous notion, and again, I'm not referring to you.
Oh, yeah.
That you can just sort of go out into the woods and you know, pull up some roots and you're fine, when the reality of being out in the woods by yourself or even with someone else who are unprepared is extremely unromantic and probably extremely frightening. I mean, I've been lost in the woods for short periods of time, and while it's slightly unsettling, I always knew enough to give myself enough markers and to know, okay, I've been walking downhill for this long, I've been walking uphill to the west for this long, and I've never gotten truly lost in the woods.
Right.
But I can see how someone could easily do that.
Well, I will say this. I was lucky enough to be in the Army before GPS became a big part of like figuring out where you were. And I will say my land navigation skills are pretty good. So I would say that's one thing I would say, without bragging, my land navigation skills, even without a compass, are pretty good. So if I found myself in the middle of nowhere, with certain exceptions, I feel like I could gauge my location, especially if I kind of understood where I was coming from. So I feel like that's one thing, me personally, I wouldn't stress about, knowing where I was. But this is what's interesting. I had an experience once. I don't know how much you know about Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes, but specifically the dunes in the south part of Lake Michigan. But there's this huge area in the south part of Lake Michigan called the dunes. And these are like just a huge area of just sand. And one time I thought I was with a friend and I said, you know what? We're going to take a shortcut back to the parking lot. Yeah, it was not. It was like I would go over one of these dunes and think, okay, we're almost there. And then, nope, we're not there yet. And what was the worst part is that the conditions got worse. Like the scrub, the stuff that grows in the sand, as you can imagine, is nasty, miserable scrub. So you're walking through this nasty, miserable scrub, being picked on by horseflies. And yeah, and what's funny is I knew where I was. Like if you said, Dan, where were you? I knew where I was in that sort of square mile sense. But I didn't really know where I was, if that makes any sense. Like even if you know where you are in the woods, especially at night, you can get lost. That sounds counterintuitive. But like you can say, well, I'm right here. I'm in this park. But it's nighttime, so what part of the park are you in? How far from the parking lot are you? See, that's the question I think a lot of people don't ask is, how far from the parking lot are you? Sounds like a stupid question. But that's a big part of it, too. It's like, I'm kind of glad you brought this up. It's a little bit away from the outline of what we're going to talk about. But one of the first things you kind of mentioned was, you need to figure out where you are. But my point here is, dude, is even if you know where you are, you can panic. And you can still get lost. I know
absolutely.
That sounds weird.
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, it depends what terrain you're into. Like, for example, you were in a dune I've never been there, but I can picture the place where everything sort of looks the same in the dunes. You know, the scrub brush all looks the same. Another dune, another dune, another dune. And well, I completely understand. You know about where you are. If you hadn't sort of, and how easy would it have been if you hadn't had the background of being in the Army before GPS and sort of having to always be aware of your surroundings and keeping your bearings, I mean, you probably could have driven 20 miles in circles and never ever had a clue that that's where you were, you know, that you were going the wrong direction.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when there's no landmarks, it's extremely, and like you say, the forest at night. I mean, walking through the forest at night, if there's a full moon, maybe you can get away and you're going in a, you know, if you're walking beside a creek or you're walking down a road or you're walking, like almost not downhill either, then you can probably get away with it. But if you're walking on flat ground, even in a full moon, I mean, that's, you're asking to get lost.
Yeah.
You know, when you don't have it, and that's one thing I wanted to say, like, because people don't know. One way that I have always navigated in the bush, and I'm sure a lot of the other people too, is you pick a point. You know, you see a point, whether it's a tree 15 yards ahead, or if it's a tree, if you're fortunate, it's a tree or a feature that's 100 or 200 yards or 300 yards away, and you can walk towards that feature.
Yeah.
And you know, when you saw that feature, you knew where you were, and you know where you were going to end up. And then you can sort of leapfrog your way, following, you know, separate features in the general direction that you want to go, to hopefully get out of whatever the situation you're in. But if you don't pick that feature, you know, you literally will end up walking around in circles, or driving around in a dune buggy in circles, right?
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's the advice they gave us when they were training us in land navigation. And they said the same thing. It's really easy to walk in a circle. So if you want to stay straight, find a point to walk towards, you know. That's good advice. Another good thing about North America, because the scenarios I'm thinking about, just to keep things clear, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I think that people who believe that the standard methods of survival, which means you pick up the phone, you call the pizza guy, the pizza comes, I think that may be coming to an end for a while for a lot of people. I could be wrong. I kind of hope I am, because guess what? When I have the money, I love to order a pizza. But I just don't think that's reality. So the basic scenario is I think a lot of people in the very near future, and this is really sad, in the United States of America are going to become, for all intents and purposes, refugees. Okay? In fact, and right now we call them homeless people. But let's get real. They're refugees, and we're going to have refugees moving about, and that's a reality. And I guess what I'm saying is, if you find yourself as a refugee, or you find yourself in the middle of nowhere, how are you going to feed yourself? How are you going to survive? And that's really the scenario. And the good news is, if you have basic land navigation skills, chances are you'll get to a road or a highway. In North America, in Canada, I wouldn't say. But in North America, with the exception of a few places, chances are you'll get to a country road, a highway, or something eventually. Isn't that a fair statement? We do have roads almost everywhere now.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a fair statement. And especially in a lot of places, in this Pacific Northwest, you end up with a lot of logging roads, too.
Yes.
There's not very many places that you can go that far, and I would expect Washington State to be very much similar. I mean, I spent some time in Washington State, but very little. But I would expect it to be sort of like southern British Columbia, where there's very few places you can go where someone either hasn't been, or there's not a logging road or something that far away. And once you start to get a little further north in Canada, then things get a little more hairy, of course. There's just less people. So how do you survive as a refugee? Now, assuming that you're going into the wilderness now with a purpose, it gives you a sort of a larger advantage than if you just kind of ended up there when you didn't want to.
I think hey, can I interrupt you for a second, though, to set the mood? I think most people are just not going to want to be there. And that's why I think a lot of people are going to die.
No.
They're not going to want to be there. They're not going to want to change. I think there are going to be people, my friend, who are going to stare at their smart devices after they've run out of electricity for weeks until they recognize what happened. I think that's how bad the mental state is for a lot of people. I'm sorry, I'll just say it. So,
no, you're 100% true. And that's 100% right. And I mean, there's a precedent for that. Right? I think we all of us who are of our age, at least, remember Hurricane Katrina and the Superdome in, I think it was Katrina, it was New Orleans, right?
Yeah. It was New Orleans.
And all those people were told, go to the Superdome. Help is on the way.
Yeah.
The help never came for a week. I mean, it was unbelievable. And people sat there outside that place and they died of thirst.
Go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
So now you take your average, I don't know if it's your, it probably is your average urbanite whose biggest time in the woods was renting a fifth wheel or a camper van and going out for a weekend, or maybe a tent in the back of their Volkswagen, you know, Passat or something like that with a bike in the back. How are they going to go walk into the woods and think that they're going to be able to survive more than a few days? And obviously they're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people like yourself that probably could. I'm not saying it would be easy, but I think you honestly could. Because as we talked about last time, what happens in these cities when the lights go out? And I mean, worst on the East Coast where I brought this up last time, but on the East Coast where the water is pumped into the cities.
Right, I get it.
In Seattle, I have to imagine it's by gravity fed down.
Yeah, well, I don't.
Sort of, the taps are always on.
Yeah, I have never fully researched where my water comes from in Seattle, and I guess that kind of makes me stupid. But here's the deal. If the power goes out in a way that I think it's going to be permanently in some, or even just for a few weeks, if it really goes out, not just, the power went out here like last summer, but it was just the neighborhood. But if it went out like it's all Seattle type scenario, I've got a 7-gallon jug that I'm going to immediately fill with water. That's my first step. Like, that's the first thing I'm going to do. And once I fill that with water, my second step is to figure out what my third one's going to be. Like, what's my third step going to be? Honestly, I'm not going to overplan, because with respect to the city, I think things will be so dynamic and so dangerous that overthinking it could be dangerous. I want to mention something, though, to you about the refugee scenario. Here's my basic belief. People alone, yes, that increases danger. Yes, you could die, and dying alone is sad. But I also think you should stay away from crowds. So one of my basic assumptions is if you're a refugee, avoid the refugee crowds. You know, find some people you can trust, and then go off by yourself. That's why I'm talking about this stuff about going to the forest. I think a lot of people are going to be marching around on highways looking for a free lunch. But they're not going to go out into the woods. They're not going to go into the mountains for the most part. And if they do, well, as you pointed out, and they probably understand on some intuitive level, they will likely die. So a good reason to talk about this, as tough as it is to find food in the woods, is because I personally think being part of one of those refugee marches in the future, the near future, is going to be horrible. Horrible.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right. You're way better off. I would, if I was sort of in that situation, the woods would be the first place I went. And the thing that I would do is I would go with purpose.
Yeah.
I would go with all the knowledge I needed beforehand, and I would bring it with me. I would bring with me the tools that I needed. And the biggest tool you need is not, obviously, you know, 700 rounds of ammunition and 3 handguns and anything else. I mean, basically, you're probably better off with a .22 long rifle for a rifle for quite a few reasons. One, you can take more ammunition, and two, they're quiet.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have, either way, you're going to have people that are going to wander into the forest, and there's nothing, you'd think the gunfire would keep people away, but it does quite the opposite in the bush. It attracts people.
Yeah.
People who've gotten fired, and especially in that situation, they might assume that you're hunting, and now you have a meal, and their kids haven't eaten in 2 days.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing you can take into the woods, that, as far as I'm concerned, is one, obviously a way to store and contain and transport water. Number two, a backpack. Number three would be a decent knife. But also number one, two, and three is good quality clothing and shelter. You know, I don't mean you have to pack a tent and you have to pack, you know, a sleeping bag and you have to pack all of the, you know, all the Gucci crap that a lot of people have. But you better be bringing a lot of rope. You better be bringing a tarp. You know, you should probably should, if you can, bring a sleeping bag. And you better not bring anything that's cotton. Because the old saying, cotton kills, is 100% true.
Yeah.
You know, cotton loses all of its insulation value as soon as it's wet. In fact, it can actually work the opposite way, and it can drain heat from your body. Whereas, of course, things like wool and a lot of synthetic fibers will lick the moisture away from your body and retains. I think wool retains something like 85% of its thermal value when it's absolutely saturated. So there's quite a few things you can do to really up your odds. And if you had a 22, you know, because hunting deer in the forest, hunting deer anywhere, it takes a lot of pre-required skills, trials, and errors. And in that situation, eventually, you probably will get good enough at it, but you're going to smell pretty bad when you walk into the bush.
Yeah.
And your scent is a big thing. The deer can see 135 degrees, and the one thing the deer are excellent at is detecting motion. They're actually not very good at detecting still things, and a lot of animals aren't. All animals, most animals, prey animals especially, are keyed by motion. You know, I've been on hunts, coyote hunts, where I've sat, where you have to sit perfectly still for quite a long time. So long, in fact, I had chickadees that were landing on the end of my rifle, and I couldn't see through my scope anymore because that's how still you had to sit.
Yeah.
So in that case, you know, as far as sort of taking on deer stuff, I don't think that's a realistic situation for a lot of people. Shooting a squirrel. Hopefully you're fortunate enough, you might run across a beaver pond. Beavers are easy, you know, especially with a 22. Squirrels, crows, magpies. I guess you don't have magpies out there, do you? But you do have crows.
We have crows. Beavers. Hey, can I ask you a question about crows really quick? Firstly, before I get into this topic, I have to let people know, as animals go, I'm a big crow lover. Like, I think they're one of the coolest animals out there, and they're real survivors, so to speak. But if you had to eat a crow, how would you do it without getting sick and dying?
Well, if you had to eat a crow, I mean, obviously they're a carrion bird.
Yeah.
They probably are full of parasites. I've never eaten one myself, but I would assume that they... I would assume squirrels... anything, your coyotes, they're going to be full of parasites.
Right.
So cooking it well done would definitely be what you wanted to do.
Good.
So you take separate the legs off. I would take the feathers off the breast. I would pull those feathers off, and then you can just make an incision with your knife through the middle. And then generally, especially with geese, you can put your knife underneath and pull at the breast. It takes seconds to do it. And then I would pick the living snot out of it, to be honest with you. And that goes for a lot of things that you would eat. If you have the wherewithal to cook it, you are much better off cooking it well. Even bugs.
Yeah.
Because I know you had mentioned insects.
Yeah, we're going to get to insects. We're going to get to insects.
Any birds, you know, you'll get some meat off the legs. You'll get some meat off the, you'll obviously get the breasts. So cook the living snot out of it. Yeah. And if you had to eat it raw, I mean, again, this goes back to the water situation, right? If the only thing you have to do is to drink that water that's got a layer of pond scum on it, then that's what you've got to do.
Yeah.
You know, granted you may get diarrhea, but in the meantime, you're going to die anyways. So, and food's a little bit different. Like I say, you can live for quite a long time without food. The problem is, of course, if you're intentionally going into the woods, is that you definitely want to have your food sorted out pretty quick.
Yeah.
Once you get hungry, you're going to make bad decisions. You're going to start to get weak. You're going to start to get sloppy. Your chances of losing your footing, twisting an ankle, hurting yourself, that's it really starts to get exponentially higher the hungrier and hungrier you get. And one other thing I'd like to say that I should probably mention is when you do take an animal and you are gutting the animal and the rest of it, you have to be extremely careful not to cut yourself on that animal.
Yeah.
Just kind of personal experience, I was had a little too much to drink after an elk hunt and cut my hand inside an elk on its pelvis bone that we had separated. And I ended up almost in the hospital with an infection on my hand. It actually took 3 weeks. I had to go for intravenous and I had to be on pills.
Oh, my God.
So that's sort of one of the things you definitely want to take care of. And that's one of the things that animals do very well is they're very self-preservative. You know, people think that these bears and these cougars just come running out because you're in their forest and want to kill you. But that's never the case. You know, no animal, and including a human, really wants in that situation, once you're back in the food chain, let's say, you want to be very careful that you do not get a cut and you do not get infected. Because that's it, man. Like, if you're out in that situation and there's a million other refugees, there's no power, the hospitals are out of diesel, there's nothing. You really have to start taking way more precautions and things not for granted that you would have otherwise. I mean, there's stories of people who have a hangnail cut their toe and end up dying 2 weeks later of infection.
Yeah, no, that's true.
There's quite a few things. I mean, certainly there's people that have lived out in the bush for decades.
Before we go too much further, I wanted to stop on a point, okay? When it comes to hunting animals, real world versus make-believe, in make-believe land, they'll show people tramping around the woods making noise. Like if you watch a TV show, you'll see somebody with a big orange jacket on marching around the wood making noise. And I think people do hunt that way, probably. But in the real world, hunting is about stalking, isn't it? And it's about finding a spot from which you can actually observe and not making a lot of noise. In fact, ideally, a great hunter makes no noise, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to be as quiet and as still, even if you're stalking. Like you say, you see people that sort of blazing through the woods with this or that, and that's not, of course, reality. Animals can smell better. They're faster. As I said, most ungulates can see 135 degrees at one time. You know, that's their range of vision. Their hearing is phenomenal. So, and they're faster than you. So you definitely, I've stalk hunted by myself through the woods. I've actually never been successful that way. I've come very, very close. And that's actually doing what you're saying, was walking through intentionally walking through the woods, walking through game trails, walking through places that I know just by the signs and the deer are there. And it's always been thick wooded places, and I've never been successful that way. I have been successful still hunting, and that's when you find the spot that you know that there's animals coming through there, and you be as perfectly still as you possibly can. One thing that can really put stacked odds in your favor is a large hood, two really big hood. That allows you to move your head slowly without being seen moving your head.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's hard to describe how still you have to be. And I go back to the coyote hunting, because we always set up stands. They're called stands, but that doesn't mean we're sitting in a blind. It just means we're probably sitting in the snow or sitting against a tree. The other thing that you want to do, and most people would think you want to hide behind the tree. So if you know what you want to do, you want to sit in front of the tree. You want to sit in front of the fence post. If there's a structure or a rock outcrop, you want to sit in front of that rock outcrop. And you want to sit extremely still.
Right.
As long as you're still, you'll go completely, even if you're wearing the blaze orange, you will go completely unnoticed, and you'll have an unlimited field of view. Problem is when you start going behind things, like behind the fence post, behind the tree, your view is very much impeded. And in order to see around that obstacle, you have to move.
Right.
And as soon as you have to move, the game is over.
Well,
it's wild how well animals can pick up movement.
Well, I want to stop on this point for a second, because this is a good discussion. with respect to the orange vest, we're not talking about this. Hunting season's over, and in the scenario we're talking about, there ain't no hunting season no more because hunting season is year round. I mean, essentially, that's hunting season is year round in this scenario. And so, one of the questions I have is, can you gain an advantage doing everything you said, staying still, picking a good position? No motion or as little motion as possible, but also can you just gain an advantage by simply using the natural materials around you as natural camouflage for like a hide? Like, can you just build yourself a hide out of natural materials? I'm not saying any spot will work, but if you move around every day, you might eventually find a spot where animals tend to go. Water is a good example. Can't you just build a hide near the water and just wait for animals to go drink?
Yeah, you certainly could. And natural blinds are fantastic. One of the problems you may run into in a natural blind is just in the act of building it, you're gonna put out a lot of scent into the area.
Yeah, that's true.
No matter what you do, you're also, if deer or the animals that are coming happen to notice you doing that, they're going to be caught on. And I'm not saying there's ways around it. So in that situation, and like all hunters do with natural or artificial blinds, is they set them up and then they go away for a long time. So their scent eventually dissipates, the movement eventually dissipates, and the animals feel comfortable around whatever it is you built or set up. And we're talking like 15, 20 days. Now, if you're out and you found yourself a place in the woods or in the bush that you like, then that's an extremely good idea. So long as what you set up isn't also found by other people.
Right.
Because in this situation, you may run into other people. So you're going to want to hide it from the animals, and you're going to want to hide it from other people. Because once someone finds out you're there, you don't know what their intentions are.
Well, that's one of the things.
Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Nope. I was just going to say, no, that is a fantastic solution to a hunting problem if you're going to remain in that area.
Well, the one thing I would say, and again, the basic scenario is imagine you have nothing. But if you have nothing, be smart, be a scavenger, be like a crow. Find things, you know, ka! Be like a crow. Anyways, find things around you can reuse, like fishing line. A lot of rivers in this country, it's not good, I'm not happy about it, but a lot of rivers are riddled with fishing line, okay? That fishing line could save your life. And you say, damn, that's crazy, that's stupid. No, it's not crazy, it's not stupid, let me explain. Number one, you can use that fishing line, especially if it has hooks and weights on it, to fish. That's number one. Number two, you can use that fishing line to build a shelter, which also includes, you know, pulling together materials for camouflage. Because this is my next thing I want to get to. In this scenario, my friend, as I stated, hunting season, in that rhetorical sense, is year-round now. So the whole wear an orange vest and say hello to the fellow hunter in the woods, that's not a good idea. So one of the things I would say is everything you do needs to be camouflaged if you can. Like if you have a camp, if you build a camp someplace, you need to, I know this sounds horrible, but let me give you an example. If you've ever seen Return of the Jedi and the Ewoks on that fucking forest moon of Endor, their camp could be seen miles and miles and miles away. Yes, they were in a thick woods, but they had all kinds of weird shit that does not look natural. And if it does not look natural, human beings are really good at detecting differences too, but we can be fooled. And if it does not look natural, human beings, their radar goes up, okay? So if you're gonna have a shelter in the woods, you need to be really careful. And that includes with respect to having a fire. Like on the one hand, if it's hard to make a fire, you're inclined to want to have it go all the time. On the other hand, a fire that's going all the time is going to pull people in. It might scare animals away, but it's going to suck people in. So you really have to think about camouflage, don't you think, in that scenario?
Absolutely. I think you're going to want to also become very cognizant of wind direction, where you are, assuming you're in the Pacific Northwest, you're probably on the side of a hill. So what you don't want to have happen is you're cooking up your crow and the wind's blowing downhill and blowing the smell of that cooking over a very large area. I mean, it would be something that someone wouldn't notice today, but after their kids and they haven't eaten in 7 days, all of a sudden their sense of smell is going to get really fine-tuned.
Yeah.
To things like you cooking. And again, like you said, the smoke. You know, you're probably not going to be burning the driest wood on the planet, so you're going to be putting out quite a bit of smoke. And who's going to notice that smoke? I mean, those are the things that the people who would be willing to go into the bush are going to be really looking for. And if they can raid your camp, I guarantee you they will. In the scenario in which we're discussing.
Yeah, and that's one of the tough...
For sure they are.
Oh, go ahead, sorry. Go ahead.
Nope. The other thing, too, is that the other difficult part, I mean, you have two difficult scenarios, right? One, you want to set up a camp where you know the lay of the land, you know your defensive positions, you know where the hunting is. Fishing, if you have it in the Pacific Northwest in certain times of the year in certain places, is phenomenal fishing. But you're going to start leaving a lot of tracks, and you're going to start leaving a lot of signs.
Yeah.
Your average urban, I would probably never even notice. But someone like an ex-military guy or a hunter like myself would absolutely notice that there's somebody, there's a human moving around in these bush.
Can I pause
you? Go ahead.
Sorry, go.
No, go ahead.
I'm going to pause you for a second because this is a critical subject and it brings these things closer together because it sort of tightens this issue. If you think about big cats don't have marching bands. Big cats don't mix music really loud. Big cats aren't always working hard in their garage back outside cutting up wood. Big cats will hunt,
yep.
And big cats will sleep and they'll be quiet, which means that big predators in general, but big cats especially, they're careful, they're patient, but they don't make a lot of noise, which means if they're not hunting and they're not, you know, procreating, you know, whatever, they're trying to not make a lot of noise. If you're in the forest and you have food and water and you have taken care of your problems for today, and especially if you need to rest, the best advice I can recommend once you've really, really gotten yourself to a place where you have a foothold is take a rest. Take some advice from the cougar. Take some advice from the big cat. You also need to reduce your activity. It sounds counterintuitive, but you need to be smart about your activity, okay? Going out to hunt is a good use of activity. Going out to sing songs in the woods because you're communing with nature, not a great idea in this scenario. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. That would be also out of necessity. I mean, it's unreasonable to imagine that you're going to live with the same caloric intake that you have in their present lives. You know, you can be probably the greatest hunter on the planet, but you're not going to be successful every single day.
No.
It's just not probably a reality. I'm not saying you're not going to eat every day, but I don't see you eating well every day at all. Yes, you can smoke some meat and soar it that way, but it's not realistic for a lot of things. Like you shoot, okay, so you take down, somehow you manage to take down a deer. What are you going to do with all that meat?
Yeah.
Most of it's just going to end up going back to the forest, and your meal that you thought was going to last you for 40 or 50 days only lasts you for 10, because now the meat's going bad.
Yeah.
So your caloric intake is going to drop, and your activity level is going to have to drop with it.
Yeah, and in fact, I would even say this. Smoking, the idea of smoking meat as someone who loves meat sounds wonderful. The idea of smoking meat as someone who's sensitive to camouflage and OPSEC sounds terrible. It sounds like another giant red light going. Think about the smell of smoked salmon or dried salmon or the smell of dried meat or smoked meat. That is a smell that attracts a human from a long, as you pointed out, hungry people are going to smell that from a long ways away. A long ways.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, at some point, you probably would have to take that risk. Hopefully, like I said, you've been cognizant and you've watched the wind patterns and you have a decent idea of where humans are probably going to enter your area from. I mean, and that part's generally humans, everybody will take the path of least resistance.
I got a crazy.
They just will.
Okay. I got a crazy question, completely out of left field, and then we're going to talk about plants next. But before we switch to plants, crazy question.
Okay.
And the first example is going to be the rabbit, the wild rabbit. But are there animals, and I'm going to throw out the wild rabbit for example, are there animals that if you're smart and clever, you can rapidly domesticate and then breed? Like if I were to capture rabbits and put them in a pen and feed them, if I captured wild rabbits, kept them alive in a pen, assuming I checked their quote unquote reproductive organs, quote unquote, is there any chance in hell that I could breed rabbits? Because one of the thoughts that just occurred to me is that if you could figure out a way to rapidly breed some creature, like near where you live, it would be a way of having food available without having to have to hunt.
Yeah, absolutely.
But have you ever heard of that? Have you ever heard of that? Have you ever heard of that? Does that sound crazy? Is there an animal you know of? Go ahead.
Rabbits, for sure. Obviously, there's pigeons that people have domesticated before. Whether they've done so in the wild, I mean, rabbits, absolutely. There's a long history of rabbits, and especially a lot of Europeans that live in the mountains, are quite far off the grid that have been very successful with breeding rabbits. And if you could catch yourself a couple of rabbits, it might be a foray into the city. But I imagine, like most cities, Seattle is probably just teeming with rabbits.
But the woods are filled with rabbits, too. I mean, and let me give you another example. Okay, you mentioned smoking meat because you don't want it to go rotten. But imagine you've been up there for a few months and you have a settled location and you have enough equipment in order to build a pen, a big pen, okay? Literally a pig pen for the scenario I'm about to describe. Couldn't you take some of what you just hunted, put it in the middle of that pen you built, which starts out as a giant trap, and then wait for wild pigs to go for the meat and then close the pen? I know that sounds crazy, but couldn't, if you built a strong enough pen, because wild pigs are tough and they're big. And so when I say build a pen, it's probably be more like building a pit. Like what you'd want to do is dig a big pit probably, and then you'd basically, or use the natural terrain to build something. Like for example, if you're in the mountains, if you can find a draw, which is like a little valley, all you theoretically would have to do is just sort of box it up, and theoretically, you could potentially box in wild pigs, couldn't you? Oh, that sounds crazy. Does that sound pretty crazy, like trying to take wild animals and domesticate them? I mean, that sounds like how we got ourselves into this mess in the first place, right?
The reality of finding them in the first place might be a little harder than meets the eye.
But if you had a giant deer, if you killed a deer,
I think.
Yeah, but dude, if you killed a deer and you can't eat it all, and you can't smoke it because you're going to bring in other people, couldn't you use the deer to lure like a wild pig and then a couple wild pigs and then just trap them and domesticate them? I know that sounds crazy. I don't know.
I don't think pigs generally eat many deers, but you certainly could.
Pigs don't eat
deer.
Whoa, I got a question for you. Pigs won't eat a dead animal?
Oh, no, they eat a dead one.
Well, that's what I meant.
If they're hungry enough.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I think you're probably going to bring in a bear. And that's... I don't know if you want to investigate that son of a bitch, but you could try. I mean, people have. not only that, but you're pretty secure in the middle of a whole den of bears.
Actually, think about that, though. Let's pretend...
Bear king.
Yeah, exactly. Let's pretend. We have to go to plants next, but before we do, let's pretend you're not alone. Let's say after a year, you're with a group of like 50 people that have survived a year. So they all, even if they don't know shit a year ago, they've survived a year, they know more shit today. And you guys decide that you want to protect your encampment. And so someone says, you know what? It'll take a lot of work. But if we build a double wall system, we can lure in bears to breed in the inner wall, So they're essentially, imagine a double wall system where there's an inner space, and that's where the bears breed and live, the ones you capture and domesticate. I mean, think about it, though. And then you keep them a little hungry. And I know, and that sounds mean, though. But you keep them a little bit hungry. Well, that's terrible. You know what, dude?
No, honestly, just a little bit.
A little bit. A little hungry. Because they got to be a little hungry, you know? Okay, you're in the woods, dude, and there are plants all around. What the fuck can you eat? Like, if you're in the middle of the woods of British Columbia, and there are plants everywhere, what fucking plant can you eat that you know of off the top of your head?
What plant can you eat that I know off the top of my head? Just trying to think here. Actually, I've eaten quite a few of them, and, you know, once I get put on the spot, I know what not to eat. Let's put it that way.
Okay, let's start there. What shouldn't you eat?
Okay, so...
Plants.
Plants. You don't want to eat anything with thorns on it. You don't want to eat anything that has a milky white sap in it.
You said don't eat any... What was the first thing you said? You don't eat anything with...
thorns on it.
Thorns or barbs. Thorns or barbs. Okay. And then next thing
you
said
was... hairs even. Spines, hairs.
Okay.
Anything like that.
Okay.
Anything with a milky sap on it. Have you ever seen anything like that? But I have. You don't want to eat anything with white berries on it. You don't want to eat anything, obviously, that has a bitter taste. And that sort of gets you into the, well, what can you eat? And unless you know otherwise, and you're very, very good at it, you don't want to eat mushrooms.
Yeah. I don't know mushrooms. Yeah. I mean, one thing I came across today. Oh, go ahead.
No.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. If you don't know exactly what you're looking at, you can end up in a whole world of problems eating mushrooms. Like, just eating random mushrooms is sort of a recipe for not a good time.
Yeah. No, I've always heard that. In fact, and I don't know anything about mushrooms. I know slightly more about plants. Like, you know, I think I would recognize a Cherokee onion, for example. I think they're called Cherokee onions, or is that racist? I don't know if that's racist, but I think I could recognize a wild onion. And, you know, dandelion, for example.
Washington onions?
I'm sorry?
Just saying the Washington onions.
Yes, the
Washington. Redskins thing, anyways.
Yes, but I could recognize a wild onion. Yeah, the Washington onions. I think I could recognize a wild onion. Another thing I'd mention too, dandelions. Cecil mentions don't eat anything with a milky white substance. That is good. That is true. Dandelion, the stem, has that milky white substance, but the leaves of dandelion, you can eat those. And there's not a lot of calories there, but there are vitamins, there are nutrients, and it is something that, you know, is a fiber. So you can eat dandelion leaves. Lemongrass. If you come across lemongrass, and if you don't know what lemongrass looks like, it looks like a bushy hair, kind of. They're very long, thin stalks. Very long, very thin. It looks like chives. Lemongrass kind of looks like chives. You can eat the whole thing. You can eat the root. You can eat the stalk. You can eat all the lemongrass. It is also more of a fiber, so it's not really going to give you any calories, but... it does contain nutrients and vitamins and other things. I came across something also called burdock plant. And burdock is interesting because it has a kind of, it looks like other types of plants. It's one of those things where you say, that looks like everything. But burdock has a root that is starchy. And the key point is, starchy foods are the foods that give you energy. So burdock, if you take the root and you clean it and you cut it into cubes, and I believe you can eat it raw. I believe you can eat burdock raw. Although in general, if you can cook something, even plants, when you're out in the woods, you probably should. It's just one of those things that it probably makes sense. But you know, burdock something too. I came across some interesting things. You know, one of the things about burdock, and here's why I stopped on burdock, and let's just stop on it for a second. I don't know how prevalent burdock is, but burdock actually contains compounds, I believe, that will help with diabetes, and it's also a blood thinner. So it contains compounds in it, and I believe in a raw form, that would act as a blood thinner or also control for diabetes. And I think, and again, as a full disclosure, please research this yourself. If you're a diabetic, don't just use Uncle Dan's crazy, you know, plant hour as your basis for survival. That is not recommended. But I would research burdock because a lot of people have diabetes. And the reality is this, folks, if you are diabetic, the pharmacies at some point in the near future are going to stop working. So if you are diabetic, there's good news and bad news. The good news is just the fasting process itself of starving to death is probably going to help a lot of people with their diabetes. A lot of people's diabetes will simply be cured by the fact that they're not going to have food for weeks. That's the good news. The bad news is that you will die of starvation. You're going to have to eat. And for people with severe diabetes, you're going to have to come up with natural substitutes to insulin. So if you're diabetic, I highly recommend researching the plants of North America. I'm just going to get that out of the way. What do you think, dude?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's sort of one of the things that's any type, I think it's, what is, which is the one you give yourself? Is it type 1 diabetes?
Type 2, I think. I think it's type 2.
Type 2. Yeah, a lot of those people are just going to cure themselves by, one, the lack of eating, two, the lack of McDonald's and or fast food, chips, all the rest of that stuff that put them in that situation in the first place. And a lot of people with high blood pressure as well are going to be on sort of the North Korean diet of low blood pressure. Because if you lose, I think it's pretty impressive if you lose 20 pounds, how far down your blood pressure goes.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to say per se how much it is, but I know it's pretty severe. And things like burdock root, I mean, as you say, a lot of people could do themselves a lot of good by buying themselves a field guide to North American edible plants. It's hard to say sort of on audio what plant you should eat and what
exactly.
plant you shouldn't eat.
Exactly.
Because I certainly don't want people running around eating because Cecil the flea bag said you can eat this and then they get all tripped out, have diarrhea, and sort of keel over the next day.
No, and we haven't done that. And just to be clear, dude, I have not put you in that situation. Nor have we done that. Full disclosure, this is a podcast. There are notes included. There'll be links to resources. But this is not a replacement for people doing their own research. Fair enough?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I actually have one of those field guides. I don't know where it is at the moment, but it's super important to have, no matter what. I mean, if nothing else, it gives you a greater appreciation for the natural world around you.
I would also.
Next time you go hiking or you go for a walk, maybe you'll see some of those things and it'll sort of trigger you. Like, hey, you know, I read that that's something I could eat. I'm not saying that you will eat it, but it would definitely give you more of an appreciation of the abundance of the natural world that we still have today.
Yeah, and actually, this is something I've been thinking about recently, and it's something that I thought about even talking to some people I know about doing this. But A, what Cecil said, get yourself a field guide to North American plants that tells you what you can eat and what not. Research that topic thoroughly, but research is not enough. If you yourself or others or you have friends that like to go on hikes, I recommend people start training. Foraging, like actually maybe this next weekend go out in the woods of the Pacific Northwest and actually forage for foods that based upon your research you can eat. I know that you say, Dan, that sounds dangerous. Well, it's dangerous if you don't do your research. It is dangerous if you go into it half-cocked, I agree. But the reality is, if you don't train to do it now, you're going to be learning to do it in a panic later. So I almost think foraging is something that people can do year-round with respect to plants, and it's something you can train to do right now before things get to the point that there's nothing at the store. So I actually think foraging is something I'm going to start learning how to do. I have not done it before. I've read about it. I've seen pictures. But as you pointed out, it's like, you know, it's not enough just to have a book. So what do you think about getting together with people starting like right now and people just getting together and just going on foraging hikes? What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I mean, you're going to increase your odds of everything. If things happen the way that both you and I think that they will, you're certainly increasing your odds. And even if they don't go that way, let's just pretend that everything goes along and the Fed is the magic, the magicians that everyone thinks they are, and we just all plod along merrily. If nothing else, you'll have given yourself a good experience. You'll have brought yourself closer to nature, and you'll definitely feel better about yourself and your abilities that you have. And that's a big thing. I mean, not to sort of stray off. I don't want to stray off the topic too bad, but just thinking about this, I want to mention it. You know, when you talk about refugees traveling the land looking for resources, one thing that people should be probably thinking about as well as a skill to learn is either woodworking or some sort of metalworking. Just so when you come out of the woods and you go to town, maybe you have something, a skill you can trade for an item that you need.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you can bring with you some furs or whatever it is you've managed to do. But even on your journey there, you know, it just makes me think back, and sorry, I'm going way off topic here.
No, this is good. This isn't off topic, dude. This is not off topic. This is good. Keep going.
That movie about that kid is based on a true story. He went from California all the way
into the wild. Into the wild. He died
into
in Alaska.
Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that's very on how he died is very on topic. But you know, that kid learned some skills, and he worked his way all the way there. And he was useful. And I know a lot of other people have done the same thing, such as Bad Quaker Ben Stone, in his book that I read. He had some really good grounded skills, and he was able to use those skills to get the things that he wanted to do in sort of a non-traditional way. And obviously what we're talking about is certainly qualifies non-traditional.
Yeah. My problem is...
On the same time...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry?
No, go ahead.
On that Into the Wild thing sort of exemplifies one of my points that that kid, at least as the movie tells it,
he ate the wrong thing. He ate the wrong thing, didn't he? He ate the wrong stuff.
He did. He got hungry. And in his hunger, he made a very poor choice in not researching what it was he was eating because he was just that hungry. So it wasn't actually that he died of starvation. It was the actual hunger that ended up killing him. His hunger put him into he was weak, he wasn't thinking correctly, and he made just a terrible, rash decision that ended up ending his life.
Yeah. Yep, that's indeed the case. And that's why, and I want to emphasize this point one more time, that if you go into the woods foraging for food, foraging, and when I say foraging, I'm not referring to hunting. Foraging is not hunting. Foraging is where you have a little bag with you, and you go into the woods, and the stuff you can pick up off the ground and put in your bag. If you're going into the woods to forage for plants and mushrooms, research it. Double check it, especially mushrooms. Don't forage for mushrooms without doing your research, okay? Don't. It's very dangerous, and you can kill yourself. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah.
And even if you come across plants that look like something you can eat, be careful, because guess what? Animals urinate on plants, even in the woods too, and in the urine is crap. You never know what's going on. So if you have the option of washing whatever it is, not if you don't have soap, you don't have soap. But if you have the option of washing your food with water before you eat it or cook it, you should do that. It's just a good advice in general.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have water and you have fire, then you can boil it.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and we're in a survival situation. We're not trying to get the tenderest cuts on the moistest, you know, with a sort of demi-glaze on top. This is just about eating and not dying.
Now, here's an interesting...
And maintaining your strength.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Yes, and maintain your strength. Yep.
No.
You mentioned... Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, you have.
You mentioned don't eat the plants that have the milky white sap. And that's true.
Yeah.
Thistle... I used to think thistle was like this, but I came across an article that said that you can eat the stalk of thistle, which means if you strip off the outer layer, the actual stalk of the plant, which goes from the root to the flower, if you strip off the outer layer, you can eat thistle. I did not know that.
Yeah, I thought you could eat the leaves. There's something about it. I remember that. And, you know, there's actually, you can apparently eat something on Devil's Club as well. Although I'd have to be pretty effing hungry to figure that one out.
Yeah. But it's got the name, right?
Oh, Jesus. If you've ever been around that, I've been around way too much of that crap in my life, I'll tell you that much.
But you know what's funny?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
even a lot of the stuff that is otherwise poisonous, and like you say, the stalks and dandelions, and dandelions are highly nutritious. I've actually picked dandelions out of my yard because I don't spray with chemicals, and we put them on our salads.
Yep.
They're fantastic.
Yeah. And one of the things I would mention, though, too, and it's important, it's why researching this now, especially if you suffer from diabetes, especially if you're a breast cancer survivor, especially if you're someone that depends upon modern medicine to get your medicine, if you suffer from depression, if you suffer from a number of illnesses, it's really important to figure out if there are any natural analogs right now. Like, as of right now, you need to figure out what plant might have a compound in it that you can use to substitute for the drug you're taking right now. Because if you don't, you'll be in a lot of trouble. And the thing about the milky saps and all the poisons and stuff, Cecil's right. But the interesting thing is a lot of the stuff that you wouldn't want to eat actually can have other purposes. Like, there are poisons in nature that you would never eat them, but they can act like blood thinners, for example. And these are things worth researching if you have blood clot issues. So I guess I'm emphasizing the point that if you currently are taking drugs to manage an illness, you really need to research what the natural world correlates are. What are the things, what are the plants in the natural world or animal oils that you can consume to replace what that pharmaceutical thing, drug, is giving you. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, exactly. I mean, even, and as you said, some of it is poison, but if you take too much blood thinners, it's poison. If you take too much any medication,
exactly,
it's poison. So it's actually all based on poison. It's just knowing what the right amount of it is.
Exactly.
And you're very, I mean, that's very sage advice for anyone with medical conditions who plans, if the worst case scenario that we're discussing happens, that actually plans to try to survive and make a life out of it. I mean, certainly no one wants to die, although I kind of think that there's quite a few people out there that will just give up anyways. But if you do plan, if you think to yourself, you know what, I'm going to survive this, the hell with them, then yeah, you can. There's probably ways to do it. There's ways around it. And you'd be well advised to figure, you know, to find out what it is. You know, even things like arthritis, there's a lot of stuff you can do for arthritis and bad joints that is natural that you can find in nature, and even exercises you can do to alleviate a lot of the symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's one of the things, the reason why I guess I'm beating this dead horse, which you can also eat a horse if you have to, the reason why I'm beating the dead horse, yeah, exactly. The reason why I'm beating the dead horse prior to eating it, prior to roasting it over a spit before my clan of hunters, the reason why I'm doing that is because there are people, you know, people that are out there who currently do need, they absolutely need a medicine to survive. And these are people that if you want to have a chance to survive, you're going to have to figure out what that medicine would be if your only pharmacy is nature. And the critical thing here is even nature's been fucked with. We're going to get to that topic last, but nature itself has been fucked with by a lot of policies, primarily government policies. And because of that, even things you'd find in nature, you need to be careful about. You know, let's talk about this before we get to insects, because it's a great bridge topic for insects. Deer ticks and ticks and Lyme disease.
Yeah.
That's a thing that Lyme disease is something that the Nazis, you know, gave us after World War II. Their scientists helped us come up with. So Lyme disease is not natural. Okay, the name comes from a place in Connecticut, I believe, where the first instances of it showed up. But Lyme disease is not natural, but it's in nature now. It's out there. You got to be careful about ticks, right?
You absolutely do. I mean, even outside of Lyme disease, I've seen some pretty horrific things. We have a lot of ticks where I live.
Like wasting syndrome. Wasting syndrome is another good example.
Yeah. Infections, you know, sort of the one thing with ticks is the age-old adage, and people around here still seem to stick to it, was that if you smother the tick with either oil or butter, it'll back itself out, so you don't have to worry about the head, not getting the head. Unfortunately, you do that, you suffocate the tick, and it coughs up every piece of nasty shit in its body, And I have seen some wild infections out here that people have had from ticks.
Yeah.
So bad, so they almost had to have them surgically cut out. So even, yeah, Lyme disease is one hell of a scary thing. And like you said, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that that was actually put into ticks by the U.S. government.
Absolutely.
Whether that's true or not, I can't confirm, but it certainly seems like a reasonable thing. I mean, considering the track record of the government, both in Canada and the United States, it's not far-fetched to believe that whatsoever.
Yeah, and for those who want to know more about Lyme disease and ticks and Nazis and whatnot, go ahead and research Plum Island, the animal research facility. Research Plum Island. Research Lyme disease, research Operation Paperclip, come to your own decisions about this. But another example of something I think is probably related to government bullshit is wasting disorder. Now, we've all heard of mad cow disease, but a lot of people don't realize is that there's versions of mad cow amongst deer and elk population. Isn't that true?
It's absolutely true. In fact, it's pretty scary what's going on with CWD. The government sort of quote unquote tracks it, and it, like any other government thing, they do a piss poor job at it. I know some countries have taken it so seriously. I believe it was Norway. It's one of the Nordic countries, anyways. They had somehow one of the deers had come back with CWD, and they killed an entire herd.
Yeah.
I believe it was on order of 7,000 animals. They killed to eradicate it. CWD has been found in moose. It's been found in elk, and of course, it's found in deer, and it's decimating the ungulate population in North America. This is one of those like the insect thing we had sort of touched on Twitter that nobody talks about, and is unbelievably horrific. I mean, it is wreaking havoc with deer and the population. And in nature, everything's connected, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just deer. Well, the deer play a vital role in the balance of nature. And when you take one of the pieces out of the Jenga puzzle, a lot of times it doesn't collapse, but you take the wrong piece out and down it all comes.
Yes, yes. That's the essence of
I wish people would...
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
I wish people would take the CWD, and most people don't have a clue what we're talking about, chronic wasting disease, but it's a very large problem that doesn't have a happy ending no matter which way it goes from here. And if you're saying that it's possible that it was released, I would have no problem believing that at all.
Well, I don't know what really happened with it, but what I can say is this. Mad cow disease hit England about 20 years ago pretty bad. And what the chronic wasting disease looks a lot like mad cow. It does. From what it looks like the same type of disorder. So I don't really know where it came from. But you're right about biodiversity as well. You don't have to be a commie environmentalist to recognize that these creatures serve a purpose, all of them. And yeah, you're right. We start removing pieces, like say, oh, the deer, they're not important. Well, the deer do things. They help to process life. You know, the plants, they grow, they die. The deer process that life. The deer convert that life. The deer serve as food for predators. The deer do a lot of things. And so when people say things like, well, what do the deer do? Well, they do a lot. So I think, yeah, you're right. It's one of those things where It gets glossed over. Next subject is insects, eating insects. Okay, quick question, Cecil. What is the number one insect, if you were in the woods and hungry, that you would try to find and eat?
If I had access to fire and water, I would actually go for wood bugs. Or some people call them potato bugs. They have a bunch of different names. They're those little grayish looking they look like they have a shell on them.
Yeah.
Do you know them?
Yeah, and they'll roll up into a ball.
Those actually aren't insects. They're actually a land-based crustacean, if you can believe it.
I can believe it. They're land crabs.
I've never eaten one before that I've known about, anyway, on purpose, or at least when I was sober. But supposedly, if you get enough of them, it tastes like shrimp. Huh. Now, the one downside to a lot of bugs, grasshoppers, those things, is a lot of them can contain parasites like nematodes. So, and including even earthworms can contain parasites. So, obviously, in a situation where the bugs are all you have and you have no source of fire or flame, yeah, definitely eat the bugs. But if you have access to water and you have access to, a way to boil the water, then that's where I would go. You know, if that's what was on the menu, then you'd be eating pretty good. Those things are pretty easy to find pretty much everywhere.
So you're saying is, you know, and you said, did you say potato bug? Is it the proper name?
I believe that they're also known as potato bug. I've always called them wood bugs. Maybe
wood bugs?
Might be a weird sort of Western Canadian.
They look like, don't they? Yeah, go ahead. Thing. Sorry. They kind of look like small armadillos, don't they, in a way?
Yes. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. They look like armadillos in a way. They're small little armadillos. They'll curl up into a ball if you touch them. And I did not know this. He said that they're a crustacean. So if someone, you know, says, what are you eating? You can say land crab. And I always thought that meant something different. And probably does. But now you can say it and mean it literally. And it's like, I'm literally eating land crab. Okay.
Yeah. Crab's on the menu tonight, baby.
Yeah.
Crab on the Barbie, as it were.
So what's the next insect you would eat after that?
I would probably say earthworms. You know, if there was a place where they were abundant and you could find them, and oftentimes you can, in certain soil types, like sort of loam over rocks and something in the Pacific Northwest, you're probably not going to be able to find any. But in a lot of places like where we are, they're very abundant.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, they're extremely nutritious.
Yeah. Well, I think they are. And, you know, and again, on a TV show, on a reality show, I hate that term because I think it's not reality, but on some reality show where they drop some motherfucker in the jungle, you'll see them eating things raw. And if you have to eat something raw, go ahead. But in my opinion, if you can boil it, wash it, cook it properly, that's a better option. Way better option if you can do it. If you can't do it, fine. But I don't care if it's worms or bugs. If you see people on TV just grabbing a bug off the ground and eating it, I think you need to be careful about doing that, right, Cecil?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't... I certainly, especially in the jungle, but even around here, I wouldn't just grab something that I didn't... And it's the same with plants, the same with bugs. If you don't know exactly what that is, and you don't know that you can eat it, you're probably better off not... I mean, who knows what you're setting yourself up for. Is that bug poisonous? Probably not often here, but still, it's not worth the risk. And touching on back to what we were saying before, or I was saying, you don't want, if you're in a survival situation, the last thing you want to do is to recklessly put yourself in peril by doing something foolish and eating something that you didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, you could grab pretty much anything off the floor and eat it and be in the hospital in, you know, probably half an hour, 45 minutes, depending on where you are. But in that situation, there is no hospitals. There's nobody. So, yeah, you better be, again, sure of exactly what you're eating. And you also have to worry about things like nematodes, roundworm, and other sort of parasites. I mean, that could be really devastating in a survival situation.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you mentioned Bad Quaker Ben and the idea of having a good set of skills so that you can trade. I will say this. If you're a nurse or doctor out there or a small-time farmer and you're interested in topics of health, medicine, and food, I would highly – and maybe you're already an expert, so God bless you. I think you're going to do well. But if you're not an expert on the plants of North America and the animals of North America, what you can eat, what you can't eat – And also, what represents the natural pharmacopoeia, the natural pharmacy of nature itself. If you can learn those skills, you're going to be able to survive. People will want you in the town. The people who are needing a diabetes medication but can't find it, they're going to trade gold. Okay? They're going to trade silver. Why? Because they don't want to die. So if you can become an expert on plants, And more importantly, if you can be an expert on plants and breeding them, breeding herb gardens, breeding, taking splices of plants in, while you're foraging and then replanting them. If you can become good at doing those things, that's a really good skill, don't you think?
Absolutely it is. I mean, anyone in the medical profession who has taken the time and understands a little bit of bushcraft, and not much, but a little bit, and they understand sort of, you know, emergency, and this is probably where military doctors come in quite well, but, you know, if you can understand how to make do and then help people with what you have at hand and actually make a difference, you will be literally worth more than your weight in gold, as you say. Yeah. And in the opening months of whatever horrible thing may happen, I don't think gold's going to be worth the price of carrying it.
No.
But food will be.
Yep.
You know, a lot of things will be. And on that same topic, I just want to mention, and I mentioned this on Twitter a while ago, is that people really, really need to be start saving their seeds, you know, from their garden. It's a simple thing to do. Yeah, I buy these little tiny envelopes. I let the seeds dry out for a day or two, depending on what they are, and I put them in the envelope. So now you have to head out on your own in the bush. Well, it'd be certainly pretty nice if you can take with you all the seeds from your garden the year before.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, because those might not be available. And they might not be available next year anyways. So I just want to throw that in there as sort of a survival tactic is you should be saving. You should have a good store of seeds. There's no reason not to. You know, if you grew corn, then leave that corn out. You want to look up how to do corn properly. But things like peas, cucumbers, tomatoes, all
potatoes,
of that.
Potatoes. I would
no
say
reason not to be saving the seed.
Yeah, I would say here's an idea I would recommend too, and maybe you'll disagree, and that's okay. But if you're putting together a go bag, as crazy as it sounds, buy some potato seeds that can last a long time. Like, I don't know where you'd get those, but find potato seeds that are long-lasting and put those in your go bag. Because potato seeds, that too could be huge. Potatoes are wonderful because once they mature, you can replant them. You can cut them and replant them. They're a very aggressive species, is my point. So if you give them enough sunlight, enough water, the right conditions, potatoes could be something that keeps you alive. Along with other stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess if you were heading off into the woods and you were planning on finding yourself a campsite and building yourself a cabin or a log shack or a cave or a hole in the ground even, even taking a potato with you, cutting it up into smaller chunks and then planting the chunks, I mean, all a potato needs, unless they've been irradiated from the store, is just an eye.
Right.
And that eye will grow into a potato.
That's right.
And sure, the first year you may not have enough, but what you will do is you'll guarantee that you have enough seed potatoes the next year.
Yeah. That's it. That's right. And the reason why I mentioned potatoes, dude, is because the learning curve, it's like, okay, no matter what that fucker Bloomberg said, being a farmer, a real farmer, especially the kind that doesn't pour poison on their land, that's not just hard work. You have to be smart. That's experience. That takes a long time to know how to do well. If you think you're going to go off into the woods and be a world-class farmer, you're a fucking idiot, okay? My occupational profession is software engineer. Ask yourself how much those skills are going to help me in the woods. Zero. Not at all. So if you think you're going to go off, oh, it's so easy. Bloomberg said anybody can put a seed in the ground. The reason why I mentioned potatoes for all you city people is that, in my opinion, it is no accident. Potatoes are one of the easiest things to grow. Not maybe not the easiest, but one of them. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, I'm an average, extremely amateur gardener, and you almost can't fuck them up. They'll grow in sand, they'll grow in clay, they'll grow in hay. Like, you can actually grow potatoes in a box of hay.
Yeah.
You can grow these things, like, freaking near anywhere, in almost any conditions, and you're right. I mean, and a superfood, like, high caloric value, excellent storability, excellent reseedability. I mean, not that you're going to seed, because you just plant the potatoes, right?
Yep.
And they make more potatoes. They're like freaking magic, those things.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I've known people who've said, listen, I planted potatoes and I can't get rid of them. Like, they'll say, I can't get rid of the potatoes. They just keep coming back. Potatoes are awesome. You do have to do things. Like, if you're up in the woods, you're going to have to clear some area because potatoes need sunlight. They don't need a lot, but they need some. So you got to do some basic stuff. But the number of things, like, you can probably find a clearing. So you can probably find a spot to plant the potatoes. And another good thing about potatoes is that they're relatively... They're more difficult for the little creatures to steal, although you still need to take precautions. Yep. You still need to take precautions. But because their main hardy substance is underground, it's harder for the creatures to you know, the deer can eat the leaves, I guess. And that's why you need to be careful. That's why probably just planting them anywhere is not smart. But potatoes, in my opinion, as crazy as it sounds, probably one of the simplest kind of seeds to take with you, where you have at least good odds of actually getting food out of it. And since as seeds, there's no weight to that. Like, how much weight are you carrying? If you're carrying a bunch of potato seeds, that's nothing, right? Like a little bag?
Yeah. I've never grown them from seeds. I've always grown them from other potatoes. But I think I actually have I'm positive I have a couple of packets downstairs for the just in case, right? And you're right. The other thing that people would have to realize going into this is that the first year you're going to plant this garden, you're not eating all winter off of it.
Yeah.
In fact, you're probably lucky if you're going to eat anything out of it, much of anything out of it. Zucchini is a great plant. They seem to grow in really almost any condition. Not always well, but once they get a hold, you almost can't give the sons of the bitches away. Certain types of cucumbers as well, but like even if all you ever had was meat and potatoes, you can live a long, healthy life like that.
Oh yeah,
the
listen.
Russians are certainly.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, definitely. Like I would say, if you can grow beets, onions, and potatoes, and throw in some meat, you probably can live a life that way. It won't be the most wonderful life ever, but those are some things you can put together. Throw in an herb garden, and I think you can have a balanced diet. These are things you have to do if you have to do them. It's not like you say, do we want the world to be like this? I don't think any of us wanted this to happen who are sane. It's what we're dealing with. The last topic is a little bit dark, but you were talking about it on Twitter, so I felt comfortable talking about it. And before we go into it, I want to tell you a story. About a year ago, a friend of mine visited me and we went for a hike. And I've had a hard time going out in nature in the last 10 years. I grew up around the woods. Like I said, I wasn't a super hunter or a super camper as a kid, but I grew up around the woods. And whenever I was in the woods, you know what I remembered, Cecil? I remember them being loud. Like there's always noise. Okay. Even in the wintertime in the Pacific Northwest, the woods were never really super quiet. Okay, it's not to say they were super loud, but they were never super quiet. It was September. And we went into the woods, it was a very quiet experience. I didn't hear birds. I didn't hear small animals. I didn't see many insects. And in the last couple of years, kind of anecdotal, I noticed things like people's windshields. And this is anecdotal, but I've noticed that in the last few years, I haven't seen that splatter pattern you'd usually see in the summertime or the springtime where a car's going through a bunch of insects. It seems like it's been rare. The topic we're going to discuss is not just this idea of quiet forest syndrome, but more specifically, what's happening to the insects. Because whether you want to talk about it or not, it looks like insects are dying off. And if insects go away, that's a really, really, really bad thing. I know it sounds stupid the way I just said that, Cecil, but what do you think about you know, someone who says, well, it's no big deal, it's just insects?
Well, I probably wouldn't have much more of a conversation with them after they said that, because once you eliminate the bottom of the food chain, what do you think happens to the top of the food chain? I mean, and it really is a chain, right?
Yes.
Everything relies on everything else. So it's funny you mentioned about the bug spider thing, because as I said, I was first kind of alerted to this a couple of years ago. I read an article about a lot of amateur entomologists, I believe they're called, they had started to notice, and this was in Europe, they had started to notice that there wasn't as many bugs on a windshield in the summers as there used to be. So a lot of them got together through the power of the internet. Every once in a while, the internet's a good thing. And they had done a lot of really, really in-depth good research. And unfortunately, because they were quote-unquote amateurs, not government-funded or major scientific university-funded, which is basically the same thing, they were dismissed for a lot of years. And they had found a dramatic, a significant drop in insect populations throughout Europe. Eventually, they kind of spoke loud enough and people started to take them seriously enough, started looking into this, and they've been looking into it in North America, and it's staggering, the lack of insects and the extinction level of insects in North America.
Yeah.
I mean, these are everyone sort of knows about the bees, right?
Yep.
And that's not insignificant either. I mean, that's pretty severe. But you have to, the birds eat the insects. Other insects besides bees pollinate flowers, trees, everything else. When you take out the bottom of the food chain, there's nothing left for the top.
Well, and this is an important point because, listen, I am an anarchist and not an ANCOM. ANCOMs are not anarchists. I just want to get that out of the way. I don't know how anybody can call themselves a communist and an anarchist. That makes zero sense. I am an anarchist. I want to live alone. I want to respect others. But here's the deal. We share the air, we share the water, and we share the soil, which means as decent people who want to follow the non-aggression principle, we shouldn't poison the air, we shouldn't poison the water, and we shouldn't poison the soil. It seems like common fucking sense. And if you look at, for example, the Pacific Ocean, no one wants to talk about this, yeah, mainly because COVID took over the radar now, so now we're all talking about COVID or race war. But the reality is the Pacific Ocean has been trashed. There are giant deoxygenated zones in the Pacific Ocean right now. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's just get it out of the way. Fish need to breathe. You may not realize this, but fish have to breathe. So if there's no oxygen in the water, they die. In fact, one of the few things that does well in deoxygenated water are jellyfish. It turns out they're getting gigantic jellyfish now. But the water quality itself has gone down a lot. The basic insect life, the krill life, I shouldn't say insect, but the basic life in the ocean at the bottom of the food chain is dying out. So we see these things about whales, like, why are the whales dying? And if you notice, in the articles, they'll say, scientists are researching this, but they still don't know. They know, Cecil, they know. They know that, yeah, that the food chain in the Pacific Ocean is collapsing. In the Pacific Northwest, we have orca whales. And the orca whales currently are in bad shape. They're not reproducing, they're dying, or they're going away. Orca whales are not bottom of the food chain. Orca whales are literally at the top of the food chain, okay? Like us.
Yep.
If orca whales are going away, that means the entire pyramid underneath them has collapsed already, basically. That's the reality. And this is something, and don't get me started on salmon. In fact, I know what we start about insects, but I'd like to talk about salmon because I want your opinion on something. You're an outdoorsman. You must know a lot of outdoorsmen. I have my own anecdotal sources on this, which I think are more honest than the news at this point. But what has been your experience with salmon runs in the last few years?
My father, who also lives in the Pacific Northwest, is a very avid fisherman. He's very into conservation of salmon, and he just can't believe how decimated everything is. You know, he's lived there his entire life. He's been a fisherman his entire life, and lately he says he can't. He's appalled by what he sees. You know, they'll have a decent salmon run 1 year, and next year it'll just be obliterated. So, I mean, as far as salmon runs go in the Pacific Northwest, you know, no one ever talked about the damage Fukushima did.
Oh, boy. Exactly.
So, as it turned out...
And can I pause you for a second? Can I pause you for a second?
Yep.
Fukushima is still an ongoing disaster that no one talks about. It didn't really stop. It's just people stopped talking about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I was fortunate, or unfortunate enough, I was on the Pacific Coast. I was in Tofino, British Columbia, which is on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And we had gone for a walk on one of the long beaches, as they're known. And I'd never seen so much dead animals washed up on the beach, from small little shrimp to crabs. and you almost literally couldn't take a step without stepping on something. And this was in the kind of the early spring. And I asked my dad, because he lives, you know, on the island. I said, have you ever seen anything like this? And he said, no, I never have in my entire life. About 3 months later, we found out that a day and a half earlier, when we were walking on the beach, the first isotopes from Fukushima had been registered off the west coast of Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's a coincidence, but it's a pretty bloody big one.
It's not. The best information I've read on Fukushima is that it was a multiple reactor cook-off event. Definitely one reactor cooked off, which means it fizzled. And if you don't know what fizzle is, it's a partial nuclear explosion where you get a little bit of a nuclear explosion, but the rest of it just throws very, very toxic shit every direction. And that toxic shit went into the atmosphere. There are particles of Fukushima reactor in almost everybody in the Northern Hemisphere at this point. They're very small. Okay? But we all probably have a little bit of Fukushima in us at this point. That's how wonderful Fukushima was. But it gets better because they've never solved it. It continues to be a meltdown, which means that the reactor is still out of control. They still keep pouring water on it. The water leaks into the groundwater. It goes to the ocean. It's horrible. It's an insult. It is probably one of the biggest disasters in the last 100 years. And 2 days after it happened, people stopped talking about it. How fucked up is that?
I know. Man, it's so fucked up that they can't even send a robot to the basement to find the molten, to find the core, because the radiation is so high, it kills robots.
Yes.
I mean, think about that for a minute. Like, if the radiation is so high down there, in the groundwater, that a fucking robot dies. Like, how the fuck do you kill a robot with radiation? I don't even understand.
Well, it's actually not that hard. I mean, okay, so radioactivity comes in the following basic forms. It comes in the form of basically light, like X-rays and gamma rays, because when you get radioactive decay, X-rays and gamma rays are sometimes released. It also comes in the form of alpha particles and beta particles. Alpha particles are electrons, beta particles are high-energy protons, and then last but not least, our favorite, the neutron. You can stop gamma rays and X-rays with a little bit of protection. You can stop alpha radiation with a piece of paper. Or I should say alpha, beta radiation and alpha with a piece of paper, more or less. More or less. I think beta is a little more powerful. Neutron radiation, which is being released from an uncontrolled reactor all the time, you can't really stop it without several feet of fucking lead. You can't build... This is one of those situations. You know, like that old scholastic question, can God build a rock so big that he himself can't move it? You need so much fucking lead to block neutron radiation, or so much material, that they don't know how to build a fucking robot that can have that much armor that would do anything useful. That's the problem. That is really it. And it doesn't have any good solutions. And it is... And if you ever research it, it's crooked as fuck. TEPCO, which is basically General Electric, very crooked. They lobbied years before this against increasing tsunami wall protection. I'm going to repeat this. TEPCO and General Electric lobbied against people in Japan who wanted to increase the standards for tsunami protection. That's shit you got to meditate on. That's shit you got to think about.
Yeah.
But basically a week after Fukushima, we were all told it's no big deal. It's all over. It's not. It's a horrible situation.
I read that they've been releasing, because they've been trying to store all this groundwater, and they've been running out of room, and they've decided now that they've upped the allowable limit for release into the ocean, and are dumping all this highly toxic groundwater.
Yeah, they never stop. They never stop. Go ahead, sorry.
The whole prefecture, as they call it, which I guess is like a province or a state, is coated in plastic bags full of highly radioactive dirt.
Yeah.
Like, you can see them on Google Earth.
Yeah. And I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but the key thing is this, folks.
No.
You don't have to be some weird global warming theorist commie to recognize that there's some really bad things happening in the ecosystem. And I think Fukushima is a no-brainer. I think a big portion of what's happening to the Pacific right now, the Pacific Ocean, is due to Fukushima. No one wants to talk about it because it's so hard. The government lies to you, and that makes it worse. So the government tells you everything's okay. And so ordinary people will go to... I knew a person who went to the Pacific coast after Fukushima. This person looked around, thought, oh, this all looks natural. I looked around, I wanted to fucking cry. The reality is, people not from the Pacific Northwest, like, if you showed up here from another country where the rivers catch fire because that's how bad the ecosystem is, you probably think Washington State is like a natural, beautiful place. This place is trashed compared to when I was a kid. It is trashed. I wouldn't eat a fish out of the Puget Sound. If you do, check it for tumors. You'll find them. I found them. Yeah. I've been fishing. I caught a little flounder off of Blake Island back in, I think, 2009. And this is before Fukushima, actually. And it had some tumors on it. So the fact is, I wouldn't eat one fucking thing out of the Pacific at this point. Why people eat any... And I'm sorry. I know there are a lot of fishermen out there who are just pissed off that I'm saying this. I wouldn't eat anything out of the Pacific. I wouldn't. I'm sorry. Not unless you really want to get cancer. That's my general view about healthy the Pacific is at this point.
I think you're right. You know, I'm always concerned where the sort of the tuna I buy from. I always try to get it from the Atlantic. And I mean, how much better is the Atlantic? I don't really think it's
at this point. And the oceans are connected. Okay. At this point, after nine years, the insult that is Fukushima has gone around the world, or at least the Northern Hemisphere. And after 9 years, this polluted Pacific Ocean water, it's flowed everywhere. It's all connected. So I don't really know the state of the Atlantic. It might be better than the Pacific. I really don't know. I mean, there's so much gaslighting and so much propaganda and so much lying going on all sides when it comes to the environment. It's hard to get the truth. You know what I'm saying, dude? It's hard to get to the answers. Like, I listened to a guy named Dane Wigington, his podcast, and he researches geoengineering. And he will tell you that the poisons they're dumping, mainly aluminum, but other poisons they're dumping, it's gotten into the ecosystem at a nano scale. These horrible fires we're seeing, he would argue, in part they're due to the fact that trees have done uptake of aluminum, nanoscale aluminum in the trees. Well, think about what a dry tree is with nanoscale metal. It's basically a thermite candle. That's what it is. It's a thermite candle. There's no mystery in why a thermite candle would potentially create a firestorm. So there are so many insults occurring, and we're so lied to, and it's so hard to find the truth. I know I sound horrible right now. It's just... I appreciate talking to you about this because there are so few people, especially in the anarchist world, who want to have this conversation because their basic default position is, if you're worried about the environment, you're a communist. A lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people in the freedom movement, because of the way the whole question's been set up, a false question, a false dichotomy, they've kind of just react to this type of conversation. I don't want to talk about it. You're a weird environmentalist. Well, we got to talk about it because we share the air, we share the water, we share the soil. If we want to live on planet Earth, we better fucking learn that. That's my opinion.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think, just to me, I've always found it fascinating how humanity has decided that it isn't part of the natural world. Like where there's some sort of god kings above it who floated in from Mars or the moon. You know, no one takes it seriously because they don't see themselves as being connected to it. I think personally, I mean, you have these freaking environment. Now, I'm not talking you and me. I'm certainly would consider myself an environmentalist. What I'm talking is the left-wing sort of lunatics that look at every problem as something that the government needs to solve. Or we need to tax ourselves to death and that will fix it when it has nothing to do with that. But I mean, these people, one of my sons, last year, he was in high school, and one of their teachers is this big environmentalist. He claims he's against global warming, he's this and that. The guy lives, like, frickin' less than a mile from the fucking school, and he drives an F-150 with a V8, to school every day to preach to the kids about climate change. It's just like, you hypocritical fuck.
Yeah.
It's like, Jesus Christ. And that's the problem. There's such a hypocrisy in this environmentalism, because I think that everyone just detached themselves from being part of this planet. I mean, whether you want to believe that the Lord put us here, or whether you want to believe that we evolved out of the ocean, either way, we are an intrinsic part of this planet, and yet we operate like it's our toilet, basically, you know?
Well, think about this.
It's outrageous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Think about this, for example, because this is a good discussion to close on. But think about this. I live in Seattle, and it's ostensibly kind of a liberal commie hellhole with ostensibly environmentally aware people. These environmentally aware people will go on camping trips, and they'll pack out their shit, and they'll be all conversational about whatnot. But when they come back here, they'll pour fucking shit on their lawns. Terrible, terrible poisonous shit. What they should be doing is growing just Pacific Northwest plants at this point. If you even give a fuck about the ecosystem here, there shouldn't be one foreign fucking plant in your lawn. But what's worse is they'll pour this nasty ass poison on their lawn. And then they'll say, why are the salmon dying? Why are we having problems with the streams? Why is there an algae bloom in the lake? Oh, can you go get some more Miracle-Gro for the lawn, honey, on your way to the Democratic caucus? It's a ridiculous... There's a philosophy of pack your shit out, okay? Why don't we treat our whole life that way? That's kind of how we should all be. I'm not perfect, dude. Don't get me wrong, okay? And I live in the city, which means I live dirty, okay? You cannot live in the city without living dirty. One more interesting point I think we should recognize. You cannot stack predators without damaging the environment. Okay? Humans have always been destructive. We stack ourselves. We build cities. Well, I shouldn't say always, but once we start building cities, and let's just get that out of the way, once we start building cities, I don't care if it's the ancient world or the modern world. Anytime you stack humans too close together, you're gonna produce pollution. Okay? You know, it's like someone says, could you have a billion Bengal tigers in India? Yeah, probably for about a month. And it will be one of the worst months of India ever. And that's all because the Bengal tigers cannot survive. Okay, predators. I read once a wolf. One wolf needs approximately 10 square miles. One wolf of natural healthy terrain. So why do we think we can stack a million people and not damage the environment, even if all we're doing is eating and pooping? Okay, you're going to impact the environment. Get over it. This idea that we can stack people. It's like, I hate it. People will bring up this bullshit about a billion people in Texas. You put a billion people in Texas, you're going to have to rename the Gulf of Mexico officially the Gulf of Poop. Sorry. That's it. That's it.
That's the truth, man. That's just the truth. I mean, you just think of what you're saying. It reminds me of watching a little mini documentary on England back through its history and the poop, and they had actually filled up the Thames River so full of fucking shit that when the inevitable drought came, the city stunk so bad they had to pay people to go down to the river, shovel up the yards and yards thick of human waste and truck it out to the sea and dump it in the ocean.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Now, I want to head out blame people for living in a city. I mean, it's an easy existence, certainly. It still is right now, it's a convenient existence. But I don't know, it isn't for me.
I think...
So I certainly don't fault people for doing it, I can't even live in a fucking town. Now.
Right.
Like...
I'm not opposed to cities, really. And so if people get the point, well, Dan, you hate cities, I'm not opposed to them. But what I am opposed to is what Cecil was getting at. I'm opposed to people believing that we're not part of this nature when we're back home in the city. When I'm here in Seattle, I am just as much a part of the ecosystem of Washington State as when I'm 50 miles east in the Cascades or something. Just as much. And so people need to know that they're hurting things here, too, if they're doing it the wrong way. and they're hurting their neighbors. If you go in your backyard and you start burning styrofoam in a city, you're harming your neighbors. I'm sorry. You may not realize it, but I'm just giving you a little piece of advice. You shouldn't do shit like that. But people just, they're so disconnected, Cecil. They somehow believe that there are contexts when they don't or aren't part of nature, or they can't impact it, or nothing they do will hurt it. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. And it's crazy. It is crazy, kind of.
It's absolutely crazy. And it only gets more ridiculous, it seems. You know, for all this stuff that the government sinks money into and tries to do and this and that, and it always freaking backfires. You look at these, and probably going way too far off topic, but James, the one other thing that I see as far as the oceans go, you know, they banned plastic straws on the West Coast, and they banned them pretty much everywhere. And what do we replace them with now? Masks.
Yeah.
You know how many goddamn masks, and I can only imagine how many you've seen around, but just in the most fucked up places, man. Like, I live an hour out of town, and from any major town, and I see masks out here on the gravel road. I've seen one.
I wish masks, you know, Cecil, honestly, though, I wish masks were the worst things I see. Mostly since the beginning of this bullshit, it's been like people, and I mean mainly the city, has stopped cleaning. Has stopped really collecting garbage regularly. And so the streets are just getting dirtier and dirtier. And it's masks, it's everything. It's garbage, garbage, garbage. And Little Saigon's been kind of dirty since I moved here, but it's just gotten worse, dude. It's just gotten worse. It's not
really?
It's not great, yeah.
So the city's just... Okay,
they're still collecting garbage, technically. They're still kind of cleaning, but it's not like it was a year ago. It's really gotten degraded.
Really?
Yeah. It's gotten dirty, dude. Filthy here.
That's wild. I always thought Seattle was sort of like Vancouver. It's kind of a somewhat clean town as far as, you know,
it used to be. It used to be. Like so many other things in the Puget Sound, Cecil, it used to be. It used to be.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's not anymore, dude. And so, you know, as we close this out, and I just want to say before we close out, just before we do, dude, it rocks to talk to you. I know that I can't pay you for your time, and you're doing this voluntarily, but you know a lot of stuff, and it's enjoyable talking about the outdoors. I am not an outdoorsman, but vicariously, I do enjoy learning from you, and I do think that at least getting people the spark of, you need to research this. Like I said, if I can emphasize any point before we close out, if you are currently diabetic, type 1, type 2, if you're currently someone who's on heart medication, if you're currently someone who has a risk for cancer, you need to immediately pick up resources to help you identify plants in nature. You need to. I know you're going to say, oh, that's crazy, Dan. That's crazy. You need to do this. You need to learn if there are plants you can consume that can replace a drug, because those drugs might come back one day. I hope they do. But best case scenario, the way I'm looking at things, there could be months or years where you're not going to be able to get those drugs. And a lot of people have syndromes where that's basically a death sentence. So please research alternatives to the way in which we practice medicine currently. That can be sustained in a world where you don't have access to basically a drugstore or a pharmacy. That's why I want to close. Do you have a closing thought you want to close on?
Yeah, I just want to add to that actually. Not only just that, but if you, as I said earlier, a small cut when there's no, maybe it'll heal, but maybe it won't. So even if you don't have diabetes, even if you don't have any underlying medical conditions, it is absolutely worth your time and the few dollars it costs, which is almost nothing now that the internet's around, although I would highly recommend having a paperback copy or a paper copy, for natural anesthetics. You know, how do you wash your hands before you're going to eat? You can actually just add fire ash into water if you have a fire, and it makes a pretty decent soap. But a lot of these things you really need to... People need to start thinking about, like, well, what am I going to do if I get a cut? What am I going to do if it gets infected? What am I going to do if I have a headache? What am I going to do if my tooth goes out and there's no more dentists. You know, a lot of these things. How do I make a fire? Like, so many little things that only take minutes a day. And people say, well, I don't have any time. You know what? Turn off your goddamn television, cut the goddamn cable, and take that money that you were spending on that and spend it on yourself instead.
Yeah. And in the very least, if you can learn how to forage, it involves walking, it involves hiking, it involves exercise. So just foraging by itself can get you out there. And I don't know, it's a weird thing to think about. Tonight, I truly hadn't thought about this, but just tonight I thought, you know what? I think I'm going to want to learn how to forage because I think I'm going to need to know how to do that if I want to survive. So I think
yeah,
I'm gonna try.
I think
I'm gonna start trying to do that. There's not a lot of places where, like, let's say, okay. So I came across an article tonight that basically said, but make sure, and I'll quote. Here's the quote: avoid harvesting from the side of the road, abandoned lots, and other toxic sites. And I'm thinking, well, that's basically everything in my neighborhood. So I have to go. Another thing is too, dude. You have to know something about Seattle. Seattle is a place of dirty little secrets. There's a, you know, the Pacific Northwest might still have places that are natural, quote unquote. There's a lot of toxic shit that's been dumped around here. So if you're going to go eat a dandelion leaf in Seattle, just do a little bit of research. Because honestly, I don't know if there's one fucking thing I could eat around here that wouldn't be kind of poisonous. I really don't know. I think a lot of life itself isn't doing so great around here, so I'm not sure I would do any better. But I do think I'm going to try to catch the bus because they still run, and you can catch a bus to go out to like Mount Si. And I think I may try to do this. I think one of my goals may be in the next 2 months to learn how to forage, assuming we have a couple months left. Anyways, hey,
yeah, that's a worthy goal.
It is a worthy goal.
Plus, don't forget to take your compass out there and reacquaint yourself if you have one.
Oh, yeah. I got a compass. I don't have everything I want to have as far as being prepared to have at least a 1 in 1,000 chance. I don't ever expect to have better than a 1 in 1,000 chance. But I have basically the things for getting me to the 1 in 1,000 chance category. That's about as well as I think I'll do. But, dude.
I think it's.
Oh, go ahead.
Yep. No, I was going to say that it's as well as anyone can do. Like you said earlier, nobody knows what's going to happen. So being prepared is, like, I'll never be as prepared as I ever wanted to be. So let's just get it on now.
Yeah. Well, dude, thank you. Be safe where you are in the great, great white north of Canada. Be safe and be careful, okay, dude?
All right. You stay dangerous, Dan, and it was great talking to you. Really enjoyed this.
I did too. And for all the listeners out there, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later.